This is episode 009 with David Watkins, How to Eliminate the School to Prison Pipeline.
Welcome to Z-Rated Success. Z-Rated Success. The podcast to help educators and those who work with youth to help them succeed by standing out instead of fitting in. This is Z-Rated Success. And this is Nick Zizi.
I am super excited today about our interview with my next guest. As you know, on Z-Rated Success, we are always looking for standout educators who are making a positive impact in the world. And our next educator is David Watkins. He is the Director of Equity and Diversity of Broward County Public Schools in Florida. A Tallahassee native, David Watkins holds a bachelor's degree from Florida A&M University, a master's degree from Syracuse University, and an educational specialist degree from Nova Southeastern University. For the past 22 years, Mr. Watkins has served as a teacher, assistant principal, principal, and director, all with Broward County Public Schools. An innovative and passionate leader, Mr. Watkins works with schools and communities to ensure that students have equity, access, and opportunity. He's doing incredible work in the community. We're happy to have with us on Z-Rated Success, David Watkins. How are you?
I am great. Thank you for having me this evening.
Awesome. Let's dive in. I would like to focus on school-to-prison pipeline. For some, this may be new. For others, this may be a review. But what is that? What is that all about?
So there are many schools of thought around the school-to-prison pipeline. There is a common notion that the achievement of a child has a direct impact on their future. And there is a lot of data that supports that children who have challenges in school that lead to risk factors also end up having encounters with law enforcement, which ultimately can lead to involvement in the juvenile justice system, which ultimately can lead to involvement in the criminal justice system, not only during juvenile years, but also into adult years.
Wow. Earlier today, I was looking at a few statistics on the school-to-prison pipeline. The school disciplinary policies disproportionately affect Black students. It's stated that 31% of school-related arrests are of Black students. And Black students are suspended and expelled three times more than white students. And it just goes on and on. So as educators, how can we address this issue? But for the time being, I want us to focus on the what, and then later we'll talk about the solutions. But as far as this issue here, what else is there to know as educators?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to have an honest conversation about is racism, and understanding that there are some institutional racism that contributes to creating policies and practices that marginalize children, that disenfranchises people. And oftentimes, the most marginalized and disenfranchised people are overrepresented by African Americans, people of color in general. So when we talk about the education system, then we have to look at the conditions in which children are introduced to our education system. And there's a wide gap in some cases in how children are introduced to our education system. So we have to think about how our children coming to school. Now, we can talk about there is a word gap from birth to kindergarten, where there we know that there's a 30 million word gap between many children of color and their white counterparts, which means that if we're expecting children to be ready to learn, reading to learn by third grade, and they're learning to read between kindergarten and third grade, then that is a huge gap to overcome if our kids have a vocabulary significantly less. We can talk about achievement data such as algebra readiness by eighth grade, whether or not children have, quality textbooks, access to technology, teachers who've been stable in a school for more than 2 or 3 years. All of those are contributing factors. But to me, the number one factor that determines a child's level of engagement, their attitude about school, their self-esteem, their self-actualization, you know, has to do with how the people who stand in front of them see them when they are in their classroom. Are they humanized in that classroom? Do those teachers have empathy? Do they see themselves in those children? Do they see their potential? And so one of the things that becomes important is how we engage with them. And I know we're going to talk about solutions later on. We have to be careful about how we approach children's behaviors and see those behaviors as a function of their youth that need direction, support, and engagement in a way that helps them focus, and not as act of being mischievous, being disobedient, being delinquent. And oftentimes, as early as kindergarten, first grade, we're taking typical youthful behaviors, youthful indiscretions, and we begin to discipline them in a way that's almost criminal, that we see the behavior and we respond to the behavior, but we don't respond as quickly to the need to support and re-engage. And engagement is critical for our students who then learn from an experience that they have, positive or negative, and then move forward.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to what you said earlier about the achievement gap, that it starts early. And you said, I believe it was 30 million words. Is that right?
Right. So wow. When I'm talking about from birth to kindergarten, and when children are being exposed to words, sounds, letters, shapes, those are critically important in the developmental years. And so when children attend kindergarten, that's where they begin the process of learning to read. And so there is a timeline between kindergarten and testing that takes place at third grade. And at third grade, kids are expected to be reading to learn by the end of their third grade year. So when children are taking 5 years to learn to read instead of 2.5, then they're not going to be on target to be competitive academically, to be prepared to provide the educational needs that they'll have upon graduation. So one of the things that we have seen that is consistent, and the data is consistent nationwide, is that children who are not proficient in reading by third grade are 90% more likely to not be proficient in reading by 10th grade. So you can predict at as early as third grade whether or not a child will be reading at grade level or proficient in reading by most state standards by the time they reach the 10th grade. And 10th grade, for all of us historically, is the age of compensatory education cutoffs. So 16th birthday is the end of requirement to go to school. So most assessments for education for high school is at 10th grade, because after the 10th grade, kids are no longer required to be in school. So that's why they don't do it, say, in the 11th or 12th grade. So they're trying to catch every child by the end of the year they're expected to be in school. And so those changes become critical, because then why is it that kids aren't reading? And why is it that we have these gaps? And those are the things that my work is to explore. And then how is there any connection to kids who are not proficient and not on track for reading, math, and other subject areas? So then it leads to children who are not meeting those academic expectations display those in a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. And for African-American children, oftentimes, and I say Black diaspora, you know, African diaspora, so I'm not exclusively speaking of children for South Florida born in the United States or a generational African-American parent, but what I am speaking of are children of color in general. Mm-hmm. And how children say that I am not learning, I am not understanding, I am uncomfortable, is displayed in many ways. Mm-hmm. And for those children, the response of the teacher, of the administrator, of the school community varies based on who that child is. So a child who may reject what they're experiencing may act out by talking, may act out by getting out of their seat, may act out by being aggressive. For children of color, those behaviors don't elicit a deeper dive into maybe an academic struggle. They may focus exclusively on the behavior and then correcting the behavior using some type of disciplinary code. And so thus, you begin a tracking of a child who now is getting going from detentions to suspensions to removal from class is the long short. And for every minute you remove a child from a class, it further sets them back. And so whether they're in school separated from their class or out of school separated from their class, it impacts their learning. And we know oftentimes that missing one session of a class can be very difficult to catch back up. Imagine kids who are routinely placed in timeouts away from the learning environment, routinely placed out of school environments where being placed, you know, excluded from the school environment as a consequence for a youthful behavior creates not only resentment of the institution where they're expected to have the most safety, it then places them potentially in another harmful experience. Because we don't understand, we may not deal with what happens when they're home, but it impacts a parent who may not be able to stay home. Mm-hmm. Or now it's forced to stay home. It impacts the feeding. Children often eat at school as a meal. And oftentimes it's the safety net that they are safe at school, sometimes more safe than being at home or in their home communities. So there's another unintended impact.
So let me ask you another question about suspensions. Are indoor and outdoor suspensions effective? And if I hear you correctly, you're saying that suspensions are doing more harm than good. So as educators, how can we discipline the child by, let's say, if there's misbehavior or anything else, and not push them out? Also, are there alternatives, other ways that we can discipline the students?
Well, I think, number one, there should be consequences for disciplinary infractions. Mm-hmm. And every child deserves the right to know what the rules are and what the consequences are, as well as the parents. And those rules and expectations should be reinforced and reminded on a daily basis, on a regular basis. The other thing is discipline necessary to correct disruptive, delinquent-type behavior? Sure, you should absolutely have consequences. And those consequences, as long as there's something that kids understand, parents understand, we've discussed and agreed upon, they're fair. However, what's not fair is that we discipline children's behavior without ever telling them why they broke the rule and how we can move forward in a way that they are learning from the behavior, understanding they're reinforcing their value to the group, to themselves, and then moving on. We rarely engage kids in why the behavior is inappropriate or wrong in that instance or in that environment. And that's one of the things we have to begin to do is help kids understanding the why.
You know what came to my mind when you were saying that about the why? My children. As a parent, I'm often having to discipline my children if and when they misbehave, and we'll send them to timeout. And I find that when we explain to the child, when we explain to my son or my daughter why they're in trouble and why that type of behavior is inappropriate, we see corrections, we see change. And I think it's important as educators for us to do that with our students. So if your student is acting inappropriately or doing something that is inappropriate in your class, it's important for you to let them know why it's wrong, why they need to pay attention, why they shouldn't have their heads down when you're speaking, why they should come to school prepared, and so on and so forth. And that will help that student to correct course, to make the necessary changes. Now, as I was preparing for this interview, I read a lot more statistics and other research and reports about this prison, or rather school-to-prison pipeline. And it's very saddening. It's disappointing just looking at these facts about what's happening. And I just want to know, and I'm sure many people are probably thinking about this as well, how can we eliminate the school-to-prison pipeline? Is there a way? What can we do?
I don't know that this session can answer all of the things that we can do, because a lot of what happens in school is a byproduct, is a representation of what's happening in society as a whole. But one of the things that can be done, first and foremost, is that all teachers, regardless of their race, should engage in, number one, implicit bias training. And so how we train and educate our teachers is critically important. How they engage with children, so understanding that we all have implicit biases and we have to learn how we overcome them so that we see our children. Our education should be culturally responsive, and making sure that children can see representations of themselves. They can feel that they're included. It's an inclusive educational experience and not exclusive. And then it's important that when they're on that campus, they believe they have advocates that can speak on their behalf when they're on campus. You see that with coaches. We talk about mentoring. And of course, that's where I'm going to naturally head towards mentoring programs, mentoring people. But mentors are any loving, caring adult who can advocate for a child. And you see the difference in a child's educational experience when there's at least one person in the building they can turn to as an advocate for them. You know, check on them, check on their teacher when they are frustrated and not understanding. They don't have to use their own behavior to express a frustration or a not understanding about how education or how something's been communicated to them. They can say, hey, Mr. Watkins, yesterday the teacher said something in class I didn't like, or I got a grade that I thought was unfair. Oftentimes kids respond to those inquiries in many times inappropriate ways in that setting, but they're really just expressing some level of discomfort. And when we begin to see our kids as a part of us, we're humane in how we treat them, we're humane in how we see them, then when we respond to their we see their behavior, we don't look at it as a criminal act or act of defiance or being deviant. It's what is going on, and let me find out how we can resolve that issue.
Yes, and as you stated, you mentioned mentorship is so important. And I know many of us, I've had mentors while I was in school. I actually went to an alternative school by choice because the public school that I was attending, that I was going to at the time, there was a lot of drama. I got into fights and I just wanted to get away from that. And I was privileged to have a mentor to tell me, hey, Nick, you may want to consider going to an alternative school and complete your education there. And I did. I eventually graduated from Corporate Academy North, which is no longer around. But I think that's very important to have mentors, right? To tell you, to kind of guide you in the direction to go. Now, as far as the educators, as you mentioned, you've got to be caring. You mentioned something earlier in the beginning, and I wanted to go back to it as well. Humanize these students to let them know, look, we appreciate you. We love you. We want you to succeed. Instead of as criminals, because perhaps of the way they're dressed or perhaps where they're from. I mean, there are many other factors, perhaps because of their misbehavior, right? So with that, I know we won't be able to give the panacea, like the one size fits all solution, but I think you've covered pretty much a lot of ground, and educators can take away from this interview some nuggets that they can go back and implement at their schools. Now, what's your thoughts about expectations, the expectation of the educator to the student, of the student?
Well, when I think about educators' expectations, I think that educators have to expect that children can rise to the occasion, that they can meet when they believe teachers actually care about them, want them to succeed. Students will run through walls for you. They will work hard to help achieve what you were asking. You know, and I'll just give you a personal experience that when I was a classroom teacher, I taught the students who identified as the lowest 25th percent in reading in middle school. And those were the ones who were traditionally considered behavior problems for teachers. And I had great success with the students in those classes. And one year, I was asked to take on teaching the gifted students because of the success I was having with the most fragile students. What happens is, then the highest achieving schools are gifted program. I was moved to the gifted program. So why would I want to waste all of that talent of an engaging multidisciplinary curriculum with kids who were low performers and provide that with them? So I taught a gifted curriculum for 6 years. I was asked to go back and teach the kids at risk of dropping out. And I was asked to do that 2 days before the start of the school year, 2 days before the first day. And I know it's a little bit of a long story, but I only had a gifted curriculum. I didn't have time to take this and modify it to provide it to the population I was going back to. So there, I taught my gifted curriculum to those students the entire year.
Wow.
And of course, they met those expectations. The kids had a great experience. And that's what began more of the advocacy around the type of education kids have. Having a more diverse educational experience, using more manipulatives with students, allowing them to get out of their seat, do more vertical teaming where you are a social studies teacher, you work with the science teacher and the math teacher, and kids can do more interactive activities. So the way you would teach gifted kids is the way you should really teach all kids.
Say that one more time, please.
The way you teach gifted children is how you should teach all children.
That's it.
And when you go to these gifted classes that are overrepresented with white males, and when they talk about these kids having IEPs or EPs, they're a little bit different. They're learning plans for these kids. And they're learning plans to prepare them to be leaders. They prepare them to be critical thinkers. It teaches them a lot of life skills. And all kids benefit from these skills. And I don't mean to just consistently make it in terms of race, but the reality is a lot of what happens becomes racial disparities in schools. And we're all taught from the same education system. You know, I learned from the same great leaders that everybody else did. So my initial perceptions about how you behave in class, who's smart, how you learn, how things are taught, are coming from the same schools of thought, which they're not fair to all of the diversity in the world around the contributions that people have made to education in this country, around the world, and for many, many millennia.
Well, this is incredible what you just said. And what I love about this part here is that I've interviewed several other educators, such as Dr. Perry and many other top educators like yourself. And everyone is echoing the same thing. Like, teach them the way you would teach. Like, if you're teaching gifted students, teach your other students the same way you've taught your gifted students, your expectations, right? This is amazing. And I think if we as educators can go into the classroom knowing that every one of our students, doesn't matter what they've done, whether they're failing, whatever it is, that we can reach them, we can help them to do well in school. And that is amazing. Now, there's a lot more that we can say. And it looks like we're going to have to do a part two of this interview for sure. But you mentioned something about dropout in the beginning in your story there, dropout prevention. Now, let's say if we're dealing with a student, right, and we see that this kid is on his way to dropping out. If you would just perhaps in maybe two or three sentences tell us, how do we help stop that? How do we prevent that from happening?
we prevent that from forming a relationship with that person, introducing that person to resources both in the community and at school that can help refocus and hopefully re-engage them in education. We can also help them with a pathway to the finish line. Oftentimes, kids drop out because they don't see a pathway to the end. And if we can give them a pathway with some skills and support to help them cross the finish line, many kids often will do. But it starts with a relationship that we form with the child, and then we can provide them with that pathway.
Well, that's a great point to end the interview with. And by doing that, by preventing these students from dropping out, in fact, I read recently today, it says that of the dropouts, nearly 60% will go to prison at some point. Just imagine how, as an educator, we can change the trajectory of this kid's life if we can just put in a little bit more extra work and effort to reach that student. So that is incredible. So thank you again, David, for all that you do. If you would, can you please tell us how we can support you?
Well, one of the things, as the sixth largest district in the nation, our reach can only go so far. The funds that go to supporting public education are intended to go into the classroom to support children directly. So we do need the arm of the community stakeholders to engage with our school community through providing opportunities for them to experience some of the successes that many people have found through the variety of life experiences that you have. So we're always looking for guest speakers to speak to kids all the time. We're always looking for folks who will allow them to come and experience the community through career exploration, post-secondary opportunities, or just etiquette and life skills so that they can see that there are many ways that that can happen. And we do look for persons who they can identify with as a source where we have underrepresentation. We're always looking for those of Haitian descent, those of Caribbean descent, those who have had some challenges themselves. But they also need to find and see folks who have followed a path early on and had success. They can, you know, they don't have to be a representative of an underrepresented group. They can be anyone, but they just need to have diversity in all of those experiences so they can connect with the pathway that's best for them.
That's awesome. What are your social media handles for those who would like to follow you?
For Facebook, my name, David Watkins, is the best way to follow me on Facebook or on Twitter. It's DWatkins1, and on Instagram, it's David Watkins.
And Watkins is spelled WATKINS. For those who may not know, you can follow David Watkins on all of social media for more great information like you received today. So thank you again, David, for coming on the Z-Rated Success podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. And it's a pleasure working with you. And I really enjoy all the great work you're doing in the community and in our schools.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Z-Rated Success. I hope you were inspired today from our guests. I hope you learned some incredible strategies from our guests on what they're doing to impact their students to see them succeed. If you are interested in bringing me in so that I can speak to your students, so that I can impact them and help them stand out and build self-esteem where they are not following the crowd, I'm taking all this information that I'm gathering from all these top educators and putting them together to create the best program possible for your students. If you are interested in learning, please send me an email to info@nickzz.com, and I would love to set up a time to talk about what we do. Thank you, and remember, imitation is limitation. Unleash your zebra.
If you've received value from today's podcast, make sure to subscribe and visit ZRatedSuccess.com for more tips and strategies that will help you stand out instead of fit in. Reminding you today to unleash your zebra.
Unleash your zebra.